the new theater of the mind. The Bruce Collins Show.
Welcome back to the Bruce Collins Show. We're very glad to have you join us. Tonight, we're going to talk about two different subjects. First, private investigations work. We've gone out and, quote, hired, unquote, our own private investigator tonight to talk about the world of private investigations. And I'm sure you're going to find that very interesting. Plus, we're going to talk about the heyday of Hollywood back in the 1950s with a real Hollywood actor from that time. Later in the hour, Will Z and Steve Rowland join us. The Bruce Collins Show airs every Friday night at midnight right here at WWPR, 1490 AM. You can listen to past archives of The Bruce Collins Show at ipbn-fm.com. That's ipbn-fm.com. There's a link there right to The Bruce Collins Show page on the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcasting Network website. We would appreciate it if you're able to spread the word for our show by word of mouth, social media, or in whatever creative way you can. Also, we have a Facebook page for The Bruce Collins Show. Please like us there. And you can email the show at bruce_collins_show@aol.com. Hey, The Bruce Collins Show also has a YouTube channel. Visit YouTube, search for The Bruce Collins Show channel, subscribe, and catch all the latest shows on YouTube. Hey, and now without further ado, I'd like to bring on our guests this hour. First, we're going to talk about the world of private investigations with Will Z, and then later in the hour, we're going to talk about 1950s Hollywood with the Hollywood actor, Steve Rowland. In a moment. When I was younger, I had two dreams in my life. One was to be a professional baseball player, and then I also wanted to be a private investigator. I watched all the Private Eye shows when I was younger, The Rockford Files, which actually was my all-time favorite show, Magnum P.I., Simon & Simon, Columbo, all these different shows. And then, of course, as I got older, my dreams melted away. But fortunately, with radio, I get to live vicariously through some of my guests. And a couple months ago, actually it's been in the back of my mind for a while, I've been thinking, I got to get somebody on the show who is a private investigator who can talk about the real parts of the private investigation work and not just the stuff you see in Hollywood. So I find this stuff very interesting, and I found someone in Florida, and we're going to call him Will Z. We'll keep his last name out. You know, obviously, private investigations work is quite dangerous, and so we are going to call him Will Z tonight, and he is a criminal defense investigator at W&W Solutions Incorporated, and he's also the owner at W&W Solutions Incorporated. So we're going to talk to him tonight about the real private investigator that's out and about making a living and doing all the footwork that needs to be done out there for average citizens like you and I. Will Z, welcome to the Bruce Collins Show.
Hey, thanks, Bruce. Glad to be on.
Well, it's great to have you on. Now, I think this is awesome. And as I said before, when I was growing up, I always wanted to be an investigator. How did you, though, get into this field?
Well, Bruce, like you said, when you were young, you had a dream, and I had a dream, too. But I guess I lived too far from Hollywood. I wanted to be when I was younger, I wanted to be an actor. So yeah, as an investigator, I guess you could say I get to be an actor on occasion. And, you know, most people, they just don't know that, when I'm acting, but, it's all part of the job. It actually wasn't until about 1999 when I had to do a career change. And, I went to school originally for business and marketing, and I worked for a major communications company. Actually, I was in radio for a little while. But by my mid-20s, I'd become burnt out. I was an account executive, so having to produce you know, what I did last month, the same month, you know, I decided I had to do something else, needed to change. You know, I went to the St. Lucie Police Academy. I remember one of my instructors, who had been a trainer for the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. Well, he bluntly just told me I wasn't cop material because I was too nice. So, you know, I asked him, you know, what he thought would be good for me. You know, and he said investigations, and he was 100% right. And, you know, I just never thought I'd own my own agency, let alone to be as successful as it's been. And, you know, I did my internship. I worked for several agencies from about 2001 to about 2007. I opened up my company around 2008. It was under a different name then. It was ICDS, Investigations and Criminal Detection Services. And at the time, my idea was to do security and investigation work. But the insurance was, it was just too costly. In the industry, you've got to have $1 million policy to really get any clients. The state only requires a $300,000 liability, but you know, clients, of course, want to see more. And now my agency, you know, I changed to W&W Solutions, and I just strictly do investigation work. And basically, that's how I got started.
Fascinating. Now, in your opinion, and I'm sure this is true, but how much of it is investigation work misrepresented by Hollywood movies and television?
Yeah, Hollywood portrays private investigators as either a Magnum PI or Harry Crumb. Mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with who's Harry Crumb, a John Candy movie back in, I think, the 80s, where he was kind of a buffoon. It was a comedy show, their movie. But in reality, you know, we don't drive Ferraris, and most PIs hold a college degree, or a lot of them are former lawmen.
So how do you define an investigator?
An investigator would be a licensed person by that state. Most states do require some training or a license. Here in Florida, we have to have a license, and they've since changed that. We've got to take a state board and go through the internship. But it would be somebody trained in the, you know, the art of surveillance, or it could be research, or computer forensics, or interviewing of witnesses. There's a lot of different types of investigations one can do. For instance, in surveillance, it would be someone that could observe without being observed. That would be the goal.
And who would be your primary clients?
Clients could be someone going through a divorce or child custody. Could be an employer wanting to see if employees are stealing, or someone wanting to find out if their spouse is cheating.
Speaking of that, you were on Fox 4 News. You were featured on there, and this, at first glance, I didn't realize how lucrative, I guess you could say, the investigation work would be during Valentine's Day. But it makes perfect sense now, because there are a lot of people cheating and all of that, unfortunately, going on during that time. But do you actually see an increase during Valentine's Day for private investigators?
Sometimes, and sometimes not. Ironically, believe that or not, it's hard to say. Usually after, in January, we slow down. So I guess everyone has spent through Christmas, and up by February and Valentine's Day, you do have, you know, a few clients that are, you know, wanting to find out why there's, you know, another receipt on the credit card invoice, you know.
Or why they sat home on February 14th and their husband said, or wife, whoever, said they were working late, something like that, I imagine.
Right.
Now, do you personally, you touched on this earlier, but do you personally have to do surveillance work? And do you have any tips about that?
Yeah, I do a lot of the surveillance. In this business, the bread and butter really is workers' compensation claims. Mm-hmm. People that are you know, basically cheating the system, that are getting the check, they're saying they can't work, and we go out and find out that they are. Or they're doing activities, whether it's playing ball, baseball, or, you know, whatever activity that they're doing, that they're saying that they're too physically unable to do that. But, you know, again, I was primarily trained in surveillance, to observe without being observed. And any licensed investigator, what they would need to do surveillance, if that's the question, they would need a late model car, a sunshade, tinted windows. In Florida law, private investigators can have their windows a little darker than average. Of course, you know, a camera, a camcorder, and a laptop to communicate for reports.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned two types of cases that, to me, kind of depress me. One is people cheating on somebody else, and the other one is people bilking the system. And I realize it's a reality, and probably in some cases it's an epidemic in both of those scenarios, unfortunately. But for you personally, has that jaded you in any way?
Yes and no. If those workers' compensation claims, there's enough in the area where I'm at here in Southwest Florida, I could be busy every day, all day long.
Wow.
And not to say that all of those cases, I probably 9 out of 10, you know, just from working and observing what I've seen out there, they're doing something they shouldn't be doing. And of course, with the infidelity, we unfortunately do see a lot of that. Not as much as we used to. That may have to do with, you know, the economy, but we get quite a few of those every year as well.
Huh, interesting. Well, that's interesting that it's gone down. That's a good thing, you know. So as far as being an investigator for you, you know, we're all looking in at what you do. What consumes most of your day as an investigator?
Most of the day dealing with clients, or if I'm out on a surveillance, you know, surveillance is you could be in your car anywhere from 8 to, you know, 12 plus hours a day. So that consumes quite a bit of the day.
Mm-hmm. Along that line, if I was doing surveillance, let's say I was in my car and I thought that the person spotted me, which would mean that I was a bad investigator, which I probably would be. But if they spotted me, what would you do at that point? Just drive away?
It just depends on the circumstance and situation. Sometimes they, you know, any good investigator, doesn't matter how good you are, time to time they're going to get caught. We call it getting burned in the industry. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that time to time that does happen. And you can't foresee if the client has, if it's an infidelity and the client has said something, oh, I'm going to have you watch, then they're looking for somebody.
Yeah.
Or if it's a, you know, workers' compensation claim and they're trained, maybe they have more than one claim out and they go to a certain, you know, doctor and they're told what to look for. The attorney might tell them. And, you know, if somebody's looking, you can't really avoid that. So if you do, you do your best to either talk your way out of the situation or deport the area.
Because mm-hmm.
after that, you can't work the case again.
Yeah. You know, by and large, when I'm driving down the street, I look through my rearview mirror, but I don't look to see if anybody's following me. Now that you're an investigator, is that natural for you to kind of look around and know your surroundings?
I'm very perceptive by nature. Some people are more perceptive than others. When you first get into this field, sometimes you're following somebody in a vehicle, you think they might have seen you or you're getting too close, but as you become seasoned in doing this work, it's just something that you do and just a job like anything else. And, you give it your best and sometimes, you know, you have a good day and sometimes there's a bad day.
Mm-hmm. And along those lines, what kind of skills do you think make for a good investigator?
Good eyesight. It just depends on what, you know, aspect of the investigation they're doing. In investigations, being a private investigator, there's a lot of things, as I mentioned before, you can do interview witnesses, you can do, there's a thing set up at the state called the JAC, Justice Administration Commission, where you do, like I've done with the criminal defense, interviewing people. So it just depends on what your skills really are and try to embrace that and go after the area and expertise you're training, what you can do good, whether it's interviewing witnesses or doing surveillance.
Mm-hmm. And is your investigator license, are you able to handle cases outside of Florida?
Yeah, some states, they have a requirement to do limited investigations.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm involved in my first case that I could possibly be going into another country and watching somebody here overseas.
Wow.
And I could be testifying internationally. That would be my first case. But, yeah, most states, you can do that from another state on a limited basis. And they have to be a state that recognizes, for here in Florida, for our license to the other state.
Mm-hmm. And I have no doubt you can't talk about that case, right?
No, it's on.
Fascinating, though. Wow. Very interesting. Now, that carries some danger in itself, doesn't it? Potentially. Now, granted, I remember Dog the Bounty Hunter went down to Mexico and he got arrested. And he's a bounty hunter, so it's not like he's a private investigator. But you do, I would imagine, in certain cases, you'd have to really be aware of overseas governments and how it operates and getting all the proper things in line, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and Mexico's a bad place. I've had a former client who ended up in a Mexican prison, multimillionaire, believe it or not, and they held him for a few years down there.
Wow.
So it's definitely, you want to pick and choose where you go as well. You know?
Yeah,
the place I'd want to end up.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you ever need to locate someone, what is the ideal information? Like if somebody came to you and said, I want to locate this person, I haven't seen them in several years, something happened, or maybe recently they disappeared. What's the ideal information you would want to start out, and where would you go from there?
Well, it would be key information and as much information as they already have about the individual, such as the date of birth, their full name, maybe a driver's license number, social security number. Sometimes they have a phone number. It's not like it used to be. It takes a little bit more in having the right resources. And somebody doesn't want to be found, that's going to be really hard, because a lot of the databases, even for private investigators, they pull off of other sites such as, the DMV and an electric bill, car payment. They're looking for something to tie them to an address.
Mm-hmm. What if they – I remember years ago as a kid, and I don't know how valid these were, but I think they were in, like, comic books and things like that. And it was, like, how to change your identity. And I know some people will go to – and I probably shouldn't be handing out this information, but they'll go to, cemeteries and find out the information that way. And lo and behold, there's somebody else who passed away when they were a kid. Is it easy still to – or difficult at that point to find somebody if they're in the system as somebody totally different?
Yeah, Bruce, that's a good question. That's called going off the grid. And unfortunately, there are ways people can do that, mm-hmm. obtain information in doing that.
But at that point, is there, as it were, a carbon footprint pretty much gone? Is it hard to find them at that point?
It just depends on how good of a job they may or may not have done.
Mm-hmm. I see. So now that we have the internet, I imagine in many ways the internet's been a help for investigators. Is that true, first of all, and is that something you work with quite a bit?
Yes, it is. Now, a lot of people try to do their own investigations, and some of the free sites and out there, you can obtain limited information. But there are sites that are just for licensed private investigators, is what we use, and the average person will not have access to that.
Mm-hmm. And do most investigators have a relationship with local police, and would that be important?
Yeah, I'd say it's good to have a good rapport with mm-hmm. local law enforcement. But like in my town where there's over 200 cops, it's kind of hard. But as many as you can make a rapport with, it's only going to help you, especially if you're out on a surveillance. We do call in, let them know we're out there, and sometimes they don't get the message. And if you have a police or sheriff call or show up, it's going to not be a good day on your surveillance. It could ruin the whole case.
Mm,
but it's just part of the job.
Yeah. Now, one of my favorite shows, as I said, and this was because my dad really liked this show, and so on Friday nights I would watch it as a kid, it was The Rockford Files. And I remember with him, he was an ex-con, but he had been wrongly convicted, and he had a friend on the police force named Lieutenant Becker. And he used to have Becker run the license plates and all of that. That probably is not going on that much, is it?
Probably not so much these days. Again, good licensed investigator is going to have an online database that they can access that information themselves.
Mm-hmm. And for you personally, you've worked on many cases by now. What's the longest you've worked on a case or investigation?
I would say about 2 weeks. No longer than that. I did have one a few years ago. Actually, I had to tell the client, I've got the information. We can't keep going and doing this. They just wanted to keep tabs on somebody, but you've got to have some discernment there as well.
Yeah. Well, by the time you closed it, was it pretty much open and shut as far as you were concerned?
As far as I was concerned on that particular case, yes.
Yes. Okay. Now, as far as private investigations, we know that there can be dangerous situations within that. And maybe Hollywood has glamorized the murder case and, the butler did it and guns blazing and all that. But that does happen. And so for you, Will, what's the most dangerous situation you found yourself in as an investigator?
Now, I do carry a weapon myself, which doesn't mean you can't have one pulled on. I've been held at gunpoint twice already and don't care to go into too much detail about it. But it's good to be able to talk yourself out of a situation if you can.
And again, we're speaking with Will Z. We're calling him Will Z, Z period. For his last name, and he is an investigator at W&W Solutions Incorporated, and also an owner at W&W Solutions Incorporated, out of Cape Coral, Florida area. Now, as far as things that you've worked on, what's the weirdest investigation or request you've gotten?
I've had a few, and I'll have to say the weirdest case I've had. We're trying to obtain some information. So what we'll do time to time is we'll go out 3-4 in the morning and we'll do what's called a trash pull. And we wait, we find out when they're going to put the garbage out by the curb. We're going to go retrieve that garbage if possible, throw it in the back of a pickup truck and get on the road. And then we get suited up and we go through that garbage. Well, on this particular time, we didn't have a pickup truck accessible, so we had to use the trunk of a car. And about halfway back to the office, we start getting this horrid odor that we just could hardly deal with it. But we got it back, and by this time, the sun was just starting to come up. It was still a little dark out, and this odor was coming out. And we're going through. We get suited up in like hazmat type gear, and we're pulling through this garbage, and we find like a small bag, plastic bag, with something thick and dense in there, and there's a bad odor. And my assistant happens to open one of the bags up and see something that looked really fleshy. So we, at this point, I'm going, oh, my God, it's, a body. This guy has hacked up his old lady, and now I'm going to have to call the police, and I'm involved in this whole thing. We went and picked the garbage, and come to find out, I went over and looked at the bag and opened it up more. It was fish guts.
Oh, man.
I'd have to say that was the weirdest thing I've ever been through. So it was,
yeah. That's funny. Now, you've worked in the industry for quite a while. Has the industry changed since you've been an investigator, and in what way has it changed, if it has?
Well, just in the time that I've been doing investigations, I've seen technology changing. I think it's only going to change more with whether it's computers, cameras, the equipment that we use. And I see a big thing now with drones. I see that playing a big part in the future.
As with anything, they're starting to want to regulate some of that. So it'll be interesting. Maybe the only people who will get to use them someday is law enforcement and private investigators. You never know.
Yeah, it could be. We could change the whole surveillance system. Going out, and sitting in your car, you'd be sitting home and controlling a little helicopter with a camera on it. Who knows?
Yeah, that's true. And actually, it would probably be a better way to surveil people, because I'm sure at some point everybody would start looking up in the air to see if there's any drones around. But right now, I assume not too many people are. I'm certainly not by day. So that's interesting. Yeah. Now, Will Z is an investigator and owner at W&W Solutions Incorporated. And this has been a fascinating interview. I really enjoyed it. How can people contact you, Will, at W&W Solutions if they need investigations work?
The best way probably to be able to visit my website. That's willzpi.com, willzpi.com.
Okay, that's willzpi.com. Will Z, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
And joining us this week, it's my honor to welcome actor Steve Roland. Actually, he's done more than acting, but he's the author of the new book, Hollywood Heat, Untold Stories of 1950s Hollywood. Steve appeared in 35 TV shows like Bonanza, Wanted, Dead or Alive, and a two-year role in The Legend of Wyatt Earp. Feature films included co-starring roles in The Battle of the Bulge, Gun Glory, Crime in the Streets, and the original The Thin Red Line. And as we'll see shortly, he's done a lot more than just acting. Steve Roland, welcome to the Bruce Collins Show.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce. Great to be on.
Well, it's great to have you on. Now, you were born into a motion picture family. Can you talk about your parents and their impact on your life?
Well, my parents, first of all, my father came from Hell's Kitchen, New York. And he, as a kid, he was kind of a runner for the mob guys, picking up the money from the slot machines and the jukeboxes. And he always wanted to be in films. So they, when his family moved out to Edendale, which is now Glendale, California, he tried to get a job in the film business. And he ended up at Universal Studios. And he started at the very bottom and ended up a top MGM film director. And my mother was from the opposite end of the tracks. Her uncle was L.B. Mayer, and she was from a family of people that had a little bit, and her brother was Jack Cummings, who produced films like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, Tea House of the August Moon, and so on. So when my father ran off secretly and got married, L.B. Mayer and my mother's mother weren't very happy about it because he was from the other side of the tracks and he wasn't involved with any of that. And he didn't marry her because of her connections. And he worked his way up. And they really, really supported me. Mm-hmm. In my desires to get into the film business. They didn't like it at first, but they supported me anyway. And my father is my hero. I can't say more about him than that.
This book is, I would say, it's like a tell-all. You don't hold anything back. So why did you write this book, Hollywood Heat?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was living in London, England, and I was very successful as a record producer. And as things happen, when you get older, the industry and the street people don't really want you anymore. They want the young, hip, in touch with the times type of people. So I wasn't getting work. And I'd been telling people all along, all my friends, various stories about the different people I knew in the business. They would ask you, "Hey, Steve, what did you do with Marilyn Monroe? Or what did you do? How'd you know Jimmy Dean?" or these things. And I would tell them a story. And my friend, I had a very good friend by the name of Richard Niles, who also has a connection with the film business, he said, "You ought to write a book." Mm-hmm. So I sat down and I started writing a book. And when I first wrote it, it was rejected by everybody. But one of the people that I sent it to, it was Virgin Press. They sent me back a letter and they said, "Steve, you're not a household name. What we need is the stuff that you're writing is fine, but what we need is a hook." Hmm. So I thought, hook. So so I came back and wrote the book about all the people I knew, the encounters I had with people such as Marilyn Monroe, Jimmy Dean, Presley, and so on. And the book was sold based on these people, not on Steve Roland, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah. Many people know who Steve Roland is, and this book, I think, is really fascinating. Again, it's Hollywood Heat by Steve Roland. Now, you were, as you said, you were friends with legendary actor James Dean. What were his contributions? He really changed the leading man role in Hollywood, didn't he?
James Dean, you're absolutely right, Bruce. James Dean was 5'7" tall. I was just over 5'7" tall. And until he came on the screen, everybody in Hollywood said, no, you got to be 6 feet, you got to be dark, you got to be, you know, a Clark Gable type, you can't, you know, that type of thing. When James Dean came on the screen, he exploded on the screen. That opened the door for people like me. And I met Jimmy on my uncle's film, actually, Viva Las Vegas. I met him on the set of Giant. And we were both interested in sport car racing, and we talked about that for a while. And we became very friendly. And we talked about other prowesses in other sports. I think he was pretty good in basketball, and I was a diver. And we became friendly. And unfortunately, on the last trip, I was invited to go. I made a film with Stuart Granger called Gun Glory. And on the film was a driver by the name of Bill Hickman. And Bill Hickman was a very close friend of Jimmy Dean. And when Jimmy said, why don't you come up and see the races at Salinas? And I said, okay. And then something came up and I couldn't go. And Bill Hickman, I was going to go with him in his car because he went up to the races, followed Jimmy. So Jim was a big, big influence on my life, and probably every other person in Hollywood that was my age at the time and around my size, between 5'10" and 5'6". And then they started to say, well, we've got to get someone like Jimmy Dean to play this part. Mm-hmm. And, and now, I just interject this at the moment, we're in the process of creating a television series based on the book. Mm-hmm. And in the series, it's all about not only the book, but about the mob influence on Hollywood in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's not like Entourage, and it's not like Wicked City. It's going to be quite an interesting series because it's based on things that very few people know, but the people of my age, they do know.
Yeah.
For instance, people like Sam Giancana backed Harry Cohen at Columbia Pictures, and they put a hit out on Sammy Davis Jr. For dating, what was that girl's name? The blonde? I can't think of her name. Big star at the time. And Frank Sinatra stopped it. Got to it. I mean, well, see, these things aren't really known by everybody. Mm-hmm. And they will be in the series.
Well, I know Sam Giancana, that name comes up sometimes when you hear, you know, conspiracy theories about JFK.
Probably. I don't know too much about that. I've heard him like you have. But he really was... See, Harry Cohen was a very tough guy, and he ran Columbia Pictures. And they had a big star. God, I wish I could remember her name, because you would know right off the bat. And Sammy Davis Jr. was dating her. Hmm. And they didn't want that.
Yeah.
And they put a hit out on him. Kim Novak, that was the guy.
Okay, yeah.
Kim Novak. So the series is going to include all of this.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
I hope it's picked up. I really do.
You know, I have a question for you. This is a real general question about Hollywood because I tried my hand at, I was a big fan when I was a kid of professional wrestling, like the old school wrestling. And I promoted wrestling for a while. And I've noticed that things tend to, as I get older, I look at the stuff that's going on now, say in professional wrestling, for instance, where the wrestling is garbage compared to the type of stuff that that I was involved in or knew about when I was younger. And music has changed, and because I'm older, I don't think the new stuff is as good as the old stuff. And Hollywood is the same too. Do you think that's our perceptions, or do you think that maybe the quality is gone from all of these fields?
Well, you know, Bruce, we say this, and to a great extent, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
But you know how the world changes.
Yeah.
Everything changes. And new styles, new attitudes, everything comes in. I agree with you about the old-time stars and the old-time films. I mean, certainly my father and my uncle made many of these big films. And the perception then was, I remember the days when if there was a man and a wife and there was a bedroom scene,
mm-hmm.
the man had to have 1 foot on the floor.
Right.
That was the Hays office. They couldn't, they wouldn't allow you to show two people in bed. You weren't allowed to have black and white together. All these kind of things. Well, that's changed vastly
yeah.
over the years. And I don't know, I can't say, I mean, having been a record producer in England and working with all the hip-hop artists and everything, I can't really, you know, say that's crap compared to the old ways, the old standards. But that stuff, a lot of that stuff is standard to the kids today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how I look at it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, well said.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Now, from your book, Hollywood Heat, you write about a night you hung out with Elvis Presley and I guess his entourage or his group. Can you tell us about that?
Well, funnily enough, I called Elvis at the Beverly Hills Wiltshire Hotel. He was, I think it was the ninth floor. He and his Memphis mob had taken over the whole floor. And I just wanted to see what was going on. I called him. By chance, he was there. And I said, look, I'm gonna go out searching the town for some action. Would you like to come? And there was nothing going on, so he said, yeah. And his friend, and very close friend, George Klein, is the one that introduced me to Presley, and he was there, and they drove up to my parents' house, which is where I was staying, which was on Rodeo Drive, north of Santa Monica. And we got into, Elvis was driving the Cadillac, a black Cadillac, like a limousine almost, with dark windows. And we got in and started driving around. And we drove out to the Palisades. And I had a girlfriend out there by the name of Carol Randall. And she was always on me about introducing her to Elvis if I could. And I said, well, one day I'll do that. So we drove out there and it was about 12:30, 1 o'clock at night, and I banged on her window and got her out, and she came out to the curb and met Elvis and fainted. And then we got right frightened, and we had to get her back to her domicile, shall we say, before somebody showed up on the scene and said, "Oh God, Elvis Presley's here," and a big riot would start. Elvis was a good guy. This was long before he went to the to the army and all that. He was really a cool guy.
Yeah,
we used to go up to his house when he used to rent a house up in Bel Air, and we'd all go up there and he'd sit around the piano and sing songs. There was always 5 million people up there, and he was terrific. Very a real, real good guy.
You also write in your book Hollywood Heat, again by Steve Rowland. You write about you spent a day at the beach with Natalie Wood, didn't you?
Well, that was yes. What happened there was because of being young and teenager and kind of on the scene, the fan magazines really did lots of stuff on me. And there was a photographer in Hollywood who was really a top-class guy by the name of Errol Leaf. And one of the magazines hired him to photograph a magazine layout. Remember the old fan magazines? Your mother would remember them. They were all Movie Stars Parade and Hollywood Stars and all those. He was going to shoot this layout with Natalie Wood and me down at State Beach in Santa Monica. So we went down there, and I had a big crush on Natalie Wood, and I was desperate to try to get her to go out with me. But she was very nice to me, but in the end, when I would put on that James Dean pose, we all of us tried to act, accordingly, like Jimmy Dean, the moody, broody type of person. And I tried to do that to impress her. I was so insecure. I asked her out. And about the time I asked her out, she said, oh, call me. Up came car with a Robert Wagner in it. And off they went.
Wow. That's quite a story. Now, who were some of your favorite people to hang out with in Hollywood?
Actually, believe it or not, I didn't hang out with any of the named people. I mean, I knew Debbie Reynolds quite well. I knew Jane Powell quite well. Anne Francis I knew quite well. But I had a friend who was in a band that I formed in Hollywood that we played at all the parties and all the clubs in and around Hollywood. His name was Bud Albright, and he was a young actor trying to get a break. And he and I and Jim Mitchum hung out all the time, and I shared a house in Laurel Canyon with Jim Mitchum.
Now, you said Jim Mitchum, so is he the son of Robert Mitchum?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
He's the son of Robert. And one night, there was a big fight. Floyd Patterson was fighting Sonny Liston for the World Heavyweight Championship. And my father and Robert Mitchum and Jim and I and Bud all came up to our house. And Mitchum brought a couple of bottles of Chivas Regal. And we stayed and watched the fight.
Mm-hmm. And you knew Steve McQueen, didn't you?
I did. I knew Steve quite well. Steve got me into motocross.
Huh.
I wasn't the greatest at it, but I did compete. And it was because of Steve. Well, we did a film that got him, or not a film, a television series, that William Morris Agency put together called The Bill Longley Story. Bill Longley was one of the outlaws that rode with the James Gang. Steve played Bill Longley, and I played one of the guys in the James Gang. And, of course, while we were on the filming, we spoke about motocross and racing cars and all that. And we became friendly, and then he used me in a couple of his Wanted Dinner Alliance.
Wow.
You know, Steve wasn't a big, tall guy, and so all of us who were around 5'7", 5'8", worked a lot with him.
Mm-hmm. Steve McQueen, he's in one of my all-time favorite movies, The Great Escape. I love that movie.
Oh, great, great movie.
Yeah.
Very great movie. You know, it was Bud Akins, the guy that owned the motorcycle shop, and he was like a stuntman. He was the one that did the jump with the motorcycle over the fence.
Huh. Interesting. From my experience in wrestling, that's the only way I can kind of contrast this, is a lot of people create a character in wrestling, and yet they say that the most effective characters are the ones that are based on reality, so that person behaves in a certain way. They're a good guy, they're a bad guy, whatever, but they're sort of following certain things that are really them. In acting, is that true? In other words, if I see a Steve McQueen film, for it to be effective, is there a certain element that is actually him?
Always has to be you.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Actors Studio on the West Coast. There was a lot of guys in the class. Jack Nicholson was in the class, and Sally Kellerman, and Natalie Wood sometimes, and Nick Adams. And it was that theory, that Stanislavski method, and you had to create the character from within yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it was sense memory, they called it. You had to, you know, if you were playing a bad guy, you had to dig deep, find out your demons within you,
mm-hmm.
or your desires, or things that you would like to do, and how you would rob a store, or how you would kill somebody, in order to create the character.
Yeah.
Very little of it was script written. It was all, you'd make up your own lines. They would give you the scene, and you'd make up your own lines. So basically, it was based on you,
mm-hmm.
on you as a human being.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't really get away from yourself unless, of course, you're playing some wild person that's nothing like you.
Right.
You know, somebody that's crazy. But even then, you can still dig deep. But you talk about wrestling. I remember when I first saw a wrestling match, it was character named Gorgeous George.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that Muhammad Ali took a lot from Gorgeous George,
mm-hmm.
when he was, you know, all of the dialogue and stuff he used to blurt out. A lot of what Gorgeous George used to say.
Yeah.
I'm pretty, no one should be, remember all that.
Yeah. And I thought probably that was true, what you just told me about people having to have some authenticity within that role.
Well, most of the actors do the basic bottom line is themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they go from there. I mean, you can't get away from yourself, ever.
So in your book, Hollywood Heat, Untold Stories of 1950s Hollywood, again by Steve Roland, you talked about, I guess, an encounter where you went to the doctor, and you met a blonde yeah. bombshell, but you weren't quite sure who it was. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, that was so funny. That was a funny day that I'll remember the rest of my life. I was coming down with the flu, and we had a doctor who was a family friend by the name of Dr. Louis Machen. And he gave me the permission to come to, because I was going to, I got a part in a film called Gun Glory with Stuart Granger. Mm-hmm. And I was due in wardrobe, this was on a Friday, I was due in wardrobe the following Monday for a fitting. And then we were leaving for Garberville, California to do the first few scenes. And I'd come down with this, like, strep throat. It had been raining. And I went to the office, and I sat down in the waiting room, and I noticed there was this kind of busty blonde with no makeup on sitting across the way. And she had a bandana on her head, and she had kind of hair coming out the sides that needed to be, a look that needed to be bleached. And in the middle of it all, I sneezed, and she said, "Oh, dear, you really look bad. Can I offer you a Kleenex?" So she pulled the Kleenex out of the bag, gave it to me, and we started talking, and I started feeling better, and we got into a pretty nice conversation, and about that time, the doctor opened the office door, the door leading into his, where he gives the shots and everything. He said, mm-hmm. "Steve, I'm sorry you had to wait. Come on in now, and I'll give you the shot." So as I was going by into the office, I said, "I really would like to, maybe we can go up the road to Tiny Nailers and get a cup of coffee afterwards and talk some more." She kind of hesitated and said, "Well, I don't know. I've got to see the doctor." There was another doctor there that she saw. There were two doctors in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "I've got to see the doctor, and it depends on how long I am or what I have to do." So I went in, my heart in my throat, and I said to Lou Macho, I said, "Lou, great-looking girl out there. Who was that? She looked so familiar." He started laughing. He said, "Don't you know who that was?" I said, "No." He said, "That was Marilyn Monroe." Well, I almost died. I said, "What?" I raced to get out there to, you know, see if she'd go with me, and she left.
Huh.
I think she went out the side door or something. But that was my encounter with Marilyn Monroe. And I recognized her kind of, but she didn't look the same as she looked on the screen or in the fan magazine.
I saw you recently in an episode of Rifleman.
Oh, that, where I played the bad guy.
Yeah.
I did a couple of those. Yeah, I always liked to play the baddie,
mm-hmm.
because I thought that I wasn't at that time tall enough to be a leading man. But I could certainly play the bad guy.
Was it a strange feeling to see yourself on either the television screen or the big screen?
Well, Bruce, to tell you the truth, I liked seeing myself, and I didn't like seeing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I must admit, I played a James Dean character, where I was real moody and wouldn't go to the premiere of my films and acted all, you know, it was all stupid and, you know, phony. But they said, you know, in the papers and the book and magazine, Jimmy Dean didn't go to his premieres and all that, so I copied it. But it is a shock when you see yourself on the screen, especially today on the big screen.
While you were acting, as you said earlier, you were also performing music. So how did
yeah.
how did you end up in London?
Well, it's much simpler than it sounds. I was cast in a film by MGM called Gunfighters of Casa Grande,
mm-hmm.
with Alex Nichol, and then all the others were Spanish actors. Big stars over there. And I was cast in the role of the kid, as they called the part. So I went to Spain to do the film. And in between films, I did four more films there. In between doing them, I started going into clubs and getting up and singing. And the reaction was pretty good. And then I joined a Spanish band called Los Flaps. And we appeared at all of these big venues. And I was getting known. And there was even a big rock concert at a place called Circo Price, which is in the heart of Madrid. And we caused a riot, and they came with fire hoses and watered down the crowd. So I became known, and I decided, well, I'm getting much more excitement out of singing. And anyway, it's too hard hanging around begging for parts in Spain. I think I'll go to London where the action is and try to get a deal as a singer. So I packed up, went to London, and got deported directly back to Spain. I won't go into the whole long detail, but that's what happened. And luckily for me, the head of the record company that I went to, which was Fontana, fellow's name was Jack Baverstock, he really wanted me there as a singer. So he had to come up with a way of getting me a work permit, and they wouldn't let me back in the country. So he came up with the idea of me being a record producer, producing English acts for export to America. And the Home Office bought it.
Wow.
So I got back in the country, and the very first record I made was a record called Hold Tight by a group called Davey Dozy, Beaky Mick and Titch. And it sold 250,000 copies, and I got a Silver Disc Award. And then after that, I had 59 chart records as a record producer, plus my own hit. There's my own group called The Family Dog, where I sang lead. We had a number three record called Way of Life. When you do a lot of stuff in your career, a lot of it is overlooked. A lot of stuff that you think is wonderful is overlooked. All of a sudden, you get a hit. All of a sudden, out of the woodwork, come these people calling you about things and about, they filed a record of some obscure record you made, and you know, can I get autographed? You know, it's always happens. Like, people come out from under rocks, I think.
In good ways and bad ways. Now, the book is Hollywood Heat, Untold Stories of 1950s Hollywood. Fascinating book by Steve Roland. And before you go, one of the things that I picked up on your website, which is also steveroland-action.com, steveroland-action.com, is that you've been kind of a daredevil, and I didn't realize this, but a lot of celebrities were into go-kart racing, weren't they?
They were. We had a friend that ran a place in Southgate called the Southgate Raceways, and my friend Bud Albright and I organized a celebrity kart race, and we had all the young actors. Fabian was there, and Jim Mitchum was there, and a lot of others, and we had a girls' race, and we had a guys' races. And, man, the place was mobbed by all these fans and everything. But I got seriously into racing when I went to England. I got involved in some motocross. I got involved in kart racing. And I also, at the same time that I was kart racing, the fellow that's the world champion for the third time, Formula One, racer, Lewis Hamilton, he was kart racing as well. Because everything in racing starts at the kart level. I always say, if you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much room.
Yeah.
And I paid the price because I am mostly in pain, and my back is not good, and it gets stiff in the morning, and these injuries come back to haunt you. But I must say this, never give up your dream. Anybody that has a dream to be whatever they want to be, don't let people discourage you. Mm-hmm. Don't let people say, oh, believe me, I had people say to me, you'll never make it, you'll never do this, you'll never do that, you'll never make a record. You know, and if you listen to that, you never will.
Now, again, the book is Hollywood Heat, Untold Stories of 1950s Hollywood by Steve Roland. And you can visit Steve at steveroland-action.com. That's a great website. A lot of great information about Steve Roland there. And Steve, I hope you can come back when this TV show starts to come to fruition.
Anytime, man. Anytime you want anything, please let me know.
Thank you so much for joining us here at the Bruce Collins Show, where you can find us every Friday night at midnight here at WWPR 1490 AM. Remember, God loves you. We do too.